After working on the research for this talk tonight, it brought back some memories. There was a man who died in 1985 named Roy Cogdell, Cogdell Foundation, a great warrior for the cause of Christ, a man who dealt with institutionalism, dealt with the things in the reform movement. And I heard him one time before 1985. It was an interesting time. I didn't know the significance of it, really. But I knew that he had a special teaching that he did dealing with the trial of Christ. And in that congregation in Aleve, Texas, people would come for many, many miles to hear him talk. I remember standing room only in a building this size. Standing room only. It was quite an, event. But he talked about the legalities of that trial. And it was informational, inspiring, put you in touch with legalism of that time, the sufferings of Christ, the anxieties that those judges went through, the obligations they had to their cause of justice. But it was a great thing. I remember that. So in looking at this, it brought back those memories. Matter of fact, I pulled it up on the internet, listened to it again. And I don't know if some of you remember, some of you are too young for that, 75, but he was 86 or 5 when he died. I don't know if you remember or not, Steve. Okay? But in Acts chapter 4, I'm going to read a short reading there. I want to look at the people involved here, because they're going to come up over and over and over during the trial of Christ. Acts chapter 4, verse 23. Again, about 5 years after the death of Christ. And when they had been released, they went to their own companions and reported all that the chief priests and the elders had said to them. Chief priests and elders, you're going to see that over and over in this trial. And when they heard this, they lifted their voices to God with one accord and said, O Lord, it is thou who didst make the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. And by the Holy Spirit, through the mouth of our father, David, thy servant, did say, why did the Gentiles rage and the peoples devise futile things? The kings of the earth took their stand and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. For truly in this city there were gathered together against thy holy servant Jesus, whom thou didst anoint, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever thy hand had thy purpose predestined to occur. Destined to occur. The prophecies. The things concerning the death and the trial of Christ. The things concerning the crucifixion. The things concerning his life. Those had to come true. The trials we're going to talk about tonight center in at least two chapters of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Considerable space in the Gospels. Considerable space. That's why it's important to know how he was judged. It had to occur. As a matter of fact, in Matthew 26:1, Jesus himself knew on many occasions, this occasion especially. And this is before Passover feast. He said, Matthew 26:1, when Jesus had finished all these words, he said to his disciples, you know that after 2 days, the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man is to be handed over for crucifixion. So Jesus knew what was coming. It said this years before and months before, because it's possible they didn't understand. So this is what's coming up, this trial. You know, Josh talked about Judas in one of his talk. And he said he was the most despised man, maybe the most despised man in the New Testament. Well, I know who's number two. Is it not Pontius Pilate? So that's the man we're going to be talking about a few minutes tonight. Pontius Pilate, governor, appointed by Caesar to be over this Judea, this section of this land here that is dominated by this other religion other than Rome. And they were strong in their faith, in the Jewish faith. And they held their customs, and they held their values, and they held those things, presumably, that were given them by God. So this was a hard thing for Pilate, being an idolater, to rule. But he's got his orders from Rome. And he's in subjection to Rome. Matter of fact, his life could be in jeopardy. So it's a hard thing that he's there to be judged there. He was a judge, but he was also an authority. He had soldiers under his command. Maybe thousands of soldiers, Roman soldiers. And they were not kind. Because when you occupy territory, you've got to collect the taxes. But people are not giving in taxes, are they? Especially if they're harsh taxes. And Rome needed money for their ships and armies to maintain and hold and conquer the world. Pilate said on three different occasions, and more than that really, that this Jesus was innocent. He was innocent. But what did Pilate finally do in the end? Crucify him. He allowed that to happen. Why is that? And some things that we can learn from that. He had injustice in his trials. And those injustices, maybe we can see that some of those things and the way he judged it can reflect in our lives, how we judge things. Whether the influence of others, or the influence of society, whatever it is, influence of family. We need to think about those as we make judgments in this earth. He was a man caught between justice and conscience and his career and really his life too. Justice, conscience, career. Because usually a governor of these groups were middle class people from Rome. So ambition was part of their makeup. Now, he maintained order, he had troops, he collected taxes. And again, the occupied territories were not easy. He had political ambitions, and you'll see a lot of choices are because of life and political ambition. But he had to be careful, because Caesar and Rome wanted no riots. He wanted no wars. He just wanted taxes and things to stay okay. So that was a delicate balance that these governors had to maintain. Political, yeah. Political would use the military to enforce that. And so he compromised many things to maintain his life and ambition. Sometimes he would offend groups of Jews, and they would hold that over his head. We're going to go tell Caesar. Sometimes they did. So it's a hard thing. And he went back and forth with Caesar in Rome about his value to the Roman Empire. So that's kind of the backdrop on this. And so when we continue now, we want to establish one more point, that in Roman law, really in Jewish law is the same way, when you talk legal things, he taught that you had to be accused at a trial. What were you accused of? You needed to know the charges. What are the charges? You had to have witnesses. Witnesses that were bona fide, good witnesses. And you had to face your accusers. Sounds like today? Yeah, it was a good system they had. Rome was noted for law. Rome was noted for law. And Judaism was supposed to be that way also. Now, let's talk about the trials. I'm expanding it from just Pilate's two occasions to meet Jesus. There are really six trials. Three dealing with the Jewish people, okay, the first three, and the last three really dealing with Rome and Roman law. So I'll quickly go through some of the others. And these three trials before the Jews, that was first brought to high priest Annas. And that trial was approximately 2 a.m. in the morning after the Garden of Gethsemane, after Jesus was arrested there. The second trial was before another high priest, Caiaphas. And that was probably around 3 a.m. on that Friday. And Caiaphas had already said in John 18:14, it is expedient that one man must die on behalf of the people. And some members of Sanhedrin are present for that. So they're already looking at Jesus' death, which they had already been trying to kill him anyway. And a third mock Jewish trial in Matthew 26:59-66 took place possibly around 6 a.m. with a full Sanhedrin where the high priests were present. High priests of the Jews. So there's three trials there, 2 to 6 a.m. right after the Garden of Gethsemane. Now there were three Roman trials. The first was his trial before Pilate. He was the governor of Judea. And that was around 7 a.m., following these other three. And then Pilate, the second trial of the Roman trials, went to Herod. And it's the same Herod that beheaded John the Baptist. And then from that, it went to back to Pilate from Herod, sent it back to him around 10 o'clock or so. And that's where Pilate sent us in the crucifixion. So from the time Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus was arrested there, to the time of his crucifixion, 24 hours. All in that period. So it's a quick trial in the dark of night, which also was against the laws to do that. You had to have people present and all that sort of thing. So the whole thing was set up as mock trials. Mock trials of Jesus. Now, in Matthew 26, chapter 3, the Jews have disclosed something in Scripture to Matthew. It says in Matthew 26:3, that the chief priests and the elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas. And they plotted together to seize Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they were saying, not during the festival, otherwise a riot might occur among the people. Remember, this Passover was coming up on Friday. So they were plotting, but we can't do it during the festival. So what did they really do? That's why we see the early morning. They're getting it done before the Passover festival. The mock trials, the sentencing to the crucifixion. So it won't interfere with their religious beliefs. Such a mock.
Now,
Matthew 26:51. And behold, one of those, who's Peter, who was with Jesus, reached and drew out his sword and struck the slave of the high priest. This slave belonged to Caiaphas, and cut off his ear. We know that. And Jesus said to him, "Put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?" Then he says in 54, "How then will the scriptures be fulfilled, which say that it must happen this way?" It must happen this way. Talking of his death. At this time, Jesus said to the crowds, "Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me, as you would against a robber?" That's what he's accused of being, a disruptor, an insurrectionist. "Every day I used to sit in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But all this has taken place to fulfill the scriptures of the prophets." It was going to happen. One way or another, God knew these judges, these high priests, these scribes. He knew these Jews. He knew their hearts. And they would convict Jesus and the Gentile being Pilate. We know he was betrayed by 30 pieces of silver in prophecy. He would die between thieves. Not a bone would have broken. They'd divide his garments. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. And on about those things. So he had to die in the way that he died. So let's talk about the first trial. Now we'll be doing some reading here, and we'll probably stay in the chapters for a while. In John 18:12. It's considered the first trial here with Annas, high priest. In John 18:12, it says, "So the Roman cohort," that's usually 300, 600 soldiers. That's a lot of soldiers. "And the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first. For he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year." Verse 14. "Now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people." They know what they're going to do. They're just trying to put a few minutes next to this trials they have to say they've done something in the middle of the night. Verse 19. "The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching." About his disciples and about his teaching. "Jesus answered him, 'I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said.'" Witnesses? Yeah, there's witnesses. Where's the witnesses? "When he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, 'Is that the way you answer the high priest?' Jesus answered, 'If I have spoken wrongly, testify the wrong, but if rightly, why do you strike me?' So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest." Annas was through with him. Now, what about Annas? Can we learn anything from him? This high priest is accusing Jesus of secret, hidden things. Secret teaching. Say one thing here, say another one in secret to his disciples. And you know what? That the idea was to get the idea that he was planning an insurrection. He's planning a revolution. That he's planning violence and mobs and unrest. That he's going to be king. Well, did that appeal to Rome? Well, that's one reason Rome would kind of think about it on insurrection. And Pontius didn't want insurrection. He didn't want upheaval, because then Caesar would find out. Also, Jesus would be sinning or lying if he said one thing to this group and one to another. So, of course, what's his answer? "No. I did everything open. Everybody, bring in those witnesses. Bring in those witnesses. You high priest, bring them in. I'm on trial here. And that's interesting because the apostles in the New Testament, guided by the Spirit of God, the Spirit sent from Jesus. As an example, 1 Corinthians 4:17, nothing's hidden. The Apostle Paul teaches the same thing everywhere he goes. Whatever church he's at, he doesn't change the message. He doesn't change nuances he puts on it. He talks truth to all, the same truth. Therefore, no lies or deception. Same principle as apostles is what Jesus showed them. And so we need to always teach that way, don't we? Okay? Nothing hidden, no secrets. We need to teach boldly and say the same thing to whoever we talk to. So that's a lesson for us. Now, the second trial. I'm going to start in Mark 14, verse 53. Now, first one, Annas, high priest. Now we're going to Caiaphas. And Mark 14:53, they led Jesus away to the high priest, and all of the chief priests and the elders and the scribes gathered together. That's the Sanhedrin. That's the Sanhedrin. Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, was sitting with the officers and warming himself at the fire. And then you get all that part in another gospel about Peter and his denial and that sort of thing. Now, verse 55, Mark 14. Now, the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death. That's their aim. We've known that from the beginning. And they were not finding any. Oh, no testimony. For many were giving false testimony against him, but their testimony was not consistent. Some stood up, began to give false testimony against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands.'" Not even in this respect was their testimony consistent. Uh-oh. A bulwark of testimony, witnesses, is part of a trial, part of accepted procedure, part of correct justice. And again, mock trial injustice. Now, Luke 22. Now, this is all the high priests are here, and the full Sanhedrin's here. Full Sanhedrin. Again, we're talking early in the morning. When it was day, the council of elders of the people assembled, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council chamber, saying, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask a question, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God." And they all said, "Are you the Son of God then? Are you the Son of God?" And he said to them, "Yes, I am. I am." Significance. Then they said, "What further need do we have of testimony? For we have heard it ourselves from his mouth." Even in their law, if you admitted to it, you still had to have evidence, corroborating evidence. His second trial with Caiaphas, and now this third trial is full of Sanhedrin. Still under Jewish law, said that you needed corroborating evidence. It must be heard by two or more people. We know that from other instances. Two or more. But this was injustice. It was a mock trial was underway, and that's the way it was going to be. A mock trial in the early hours. And lesson for us. Before we make harsh and strong judgments of people, do we act on falsehoods? Do we act on gossips? Do we act on rumors? Do we act on slander? Can we recognize it? Do we act on an insufficiency of facts? Or do we just want to get something done? So we're making these judgments in life. Be aware of that. Be aware of that. In Romans 1:29-30, I'll just read that. There's an interesting thing here. We're going to talk about envy coming up in a minute. But these men here, as they judged, they were filled with, in 29, they were filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy. We'll come back to that. Murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips. So it's a hard list here, these words put together. But they're hard for a purpose, to make people think about the judgments and the information and the facts and their motives. Are they right with God? Now to Pilate, the fourth trial. This is in Luke 23. Luke 23. In Luke 23, the first verse. Then the whole body of them, the Sanhedrin, got up and brought him, Jesus, before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." So immediately you see a couple things perked up his ears, don't you? Oh, he's proclaiming to be a king? Oh, he's not paying taxes to Caesar? Interesting. You see the angle they're changing here? You've heard nothing as before this. Of course, misleading the nation is another animal. Okay? How do you interpret that from a Jewish point of view? So in verse 3, so Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Not king of the world, not king of this region, not king of Judea, king of the Jews. And he answered him and said, "It is as you say." See, he's owed up to it. Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds and all those that come in, the Sanhedrin, bringing Jesus here, "I find no guilt in this man." But they kept on insisting, saying, "He stirs up the people." What's Pilate aware of? What's Caesar looking at? He wants some order, doesn't he? He don't want in the occupied lands out there. He wants the taxes to flow. He don't want riots and insurrection. So they're making that up, stirs up the people. Teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place. Uh-oh, Pilate heard a word, Galilee. Verse 6, when Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was in Jerusalem at that time, again, for the Passover. Interesting. And I made the link already, that the Jews are trying to link Jewish religious issues with more lies concerning Jesus. Forbidding to pay taxes? That's an appeal to Rome. Wasn't true. That was political. And the word of Christ, religious, to the word king. That was political. So they're lying. They're disassociating words. And we see civil order. The idea that there's crowds and mobs and that sort of thing could occur. And Jesus. Now, but Pilate found no guilt. But when he heard he was Galilean, instead of ruling from the judgment seat, ruling from the judgment seat, already said he's not guilty, he saw a way to unload this Jewish problem on another Herod, the Tetrarch of Galilee, Galatia. They had different regions that they ruled over. So he saw a way to get out of this. His conscience. He already ruled him. He already said it, but he didn't do it in the judgment seat. But he said he's no guilt in this man. Now, the fifth trial. This is the one to Herod. So he's back to Herod in Luke 23. Luke 23, verse 8. Now Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he had wanted to see him for a long time, because he had been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. Oh, that's what he wanted to see. Well, that's proof there that signs and miracles and wonders had been done, heard, well known. These Jewish people and the leaders knew about it. But they still wanted to kill him. And he questioned him at some length, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes were standing there accusing him vehemently. And Herod with his soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, dressed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. Verse 12. Now Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day. For before they had been enemies with each other. Sounds like a motive, doesn't it? For Pilate. Why is he sitting there? Pilate didn't delegate to Herod. He made a cold, calculating action to improve a political relationship. Forgetting that a man's life and a man's well-being is not a pawn to play with and then throw away. We always need to remember that men and women are eternal and unique. In Genesis 9:6, we know that. Men and women are not pawns to be thrown away for political ambition. Also, Jesus knew Herod just wanted the circus show. And true justice about the charges was a sham, a mock trial. What'd you perform for him, Jesus? So he sent him back. So he sent him back to Pilate for the sixth and last trial. Matthew 27. Matthew 27:11. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor questioned him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said to him, "It is as you say." And while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he did not answer. And Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" They're testifying, they're not witnesses. And he did not answer him with regard to even a single charge. So the governor, Pilate, was quite amazed. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the people any one prisoner whom they wanted. And at that time, they were holding a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when the people gathered together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you? For you. Barabbas, or Jesus, who is called Christ." And verse 18, "For Pilate, he knew that because of envy, they had handed him over." In reading a lot of information about this motives for the Jews, I find one. It occurs twice. Envy. Envy. We can assign our motives as to why the Jews here in Mark 15:10, same thing, envy, wanted to kill Jesus. But the Holy Spirit says that the Jews had a savage envy for Jesus. And that was their single root cause for wanting him dead. Why? Well, Jesus had a great following. Loyal people. Good disciples. Jesus showed wisdom. Jesus had miracles to prove who he was. And what he said was from God. He is lack of sin. They saw no sin in him. Even this Gentile saw no sin in him. But this envy was a bad envy, which we read in Romans 1:29, the association of those sort of things. Deceit and murder accompany this envy. We must never have this kind of envy and jealousy to this extent. No. Honor man, honor woman, honor the creation, honor the things that are right, honor Christ and his will. Verse 20. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas and to put Jesus to death. But the governor said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release for you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "Then what shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ?" They all said, "Crucify him." And he said again, Why? What evil has he done? What evil has he done? But they kept shouting all the more, "Crucify him." Verse 24, when Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather a riot was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves." And all the people said, "His blood shall be on us and on our children." Then he released Barabbas for them. But after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified. Pilate had a conscience. Pilate had seen that he'd been innocent. There's no crime here. He's not a criminal. He's not worthy of death, much less crucifixion. But this was just for Pilate to maintain his political advantage. This was Pilate trying to maintain order. He was trying to put a moral and a political solution together. And again, to avoid Caesar's wrath. Now, Jesus is innocent. You know what he was doing? He was shifting guilt, wasn't he? "Hey, I'm washing my hands. Let's do Barabbas. That's what you guys want." Shifting. Shifting his responsibility as a judge. Responsibility because he was in authority. And he had the power. He said that. He's got the power to release, crucify, hold, scourge, whatever he wants. And he's got the army to back it up. But he has a political problem. And he has a conscience problem. He should have made a judgment from the seat, the judgment seat, as a way out. But he didn't. This was his way out. And you know what? He released Barabbas, the murderer. The murderer. The one who was really a murderer. One who really deserved justice. Because he wanted to satisfy the shouting crowd. That's in Mark 15:15. They knew how to get to Pontius. They knew his weak points. Can we make correct judgments when we are in the middle of great emotional strain? Can we make good judgments in emotional strain times? Can we just say, "Hold it a minute"? I know it's an interesting thing when my parents died that the counseling people from hospice said, "Make sure that the remaining parent, okay, doesn't make any judgments, big judgments, in the next 6 months." Maybe you've heard that. So there's things in strong emotional times that we have to think, step back. Sometimes this really has to be done. But if you can step back, your judgment will be rational, it'll be good, and you consider what Christ would do in those situations. There's one more thing. When he was sitting, Pilate was sitting on the judgment seat, and his wife sent a message to him: "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him." His wife was calling him a righteous man, and he was on the judgment seat. Wife sent a message to him. So that was trying to influence her husband to let this righteous man go. "You said he's right. You said there was no guilt in him worthy of his death. But let him go." Any advice here for us? Family. We all have families one way or another. Family advice needs to be considered before judgments are made. Why not consult another? Why not consult family? Of course, we remember Abigail and Nabal in 1 Samuel 25. She should have listened to him. Or Timothy's mother and grandmother in 2 Timothy 1:5. Timothy listened to them. Good influence. Of course, you have to judge everything. And which we saw the other night, Ahab and Jezebel. Keep them in mind, 1 Kings 18 through 21. And there's another family besides this organic family, this blood family. That's a spiritual family. Is there problems in spiritual family sometimes? How do you deal with that? You deal with prayer. You deal with good advice for these who have Christ as their future, as their present, as their forever. So think of spiritual family when you have decisions to make. Big decisions. Why not consult? Why not look to them? Us. All of us. One another. Now, Pilate compromised his sense of justice. He compromised it away to maintain his career and his ambition. We must not let that worldliness around us overwhelm our judgment. We talk about worldliness. It can warp our priorities, and it will. We need to work on that. What is right, what is wrong. What pleases Jesus is our goal, our vowed goal. In conclusion, if these six trials concerning Christ, the Son of God, a righteous man, have raised a question in your mind about Pilate's question. And what was that question he had? Something for us to think about. Each and every day, each day in our lives. Then what shall I do with him whom you call the King of the Jews? Can that not be our question? If your answer is, his will and not mine, if your answer is, I trust Jesus, then think about that. Come forward now. Let me stand safe.